This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Follow Standard Orbit, Mr. Chekhov, and take us home.
Hi, sir.
Obey. It is the word of Landru.
Joy to you, friends. Welcome to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated show about the original Star Trek series. This is a show where we dive into the characters, concepts, cliches, and other things don't start with C about the original series. My name is Drew, or Landru. I'm the TOS editor for Network. With me today is my co-host Mike from Commentary Trek Stars.
Hello.
We're just really quick going to have a little intro before we get back to the commentary.
It would have been a lot easier to say commentary. Commentary. Okay, maybe not. Never mind.
You will lose this fight.
All right.
But before we get to it, we want to let you know that about the special promotion we're running. You can win great Star Trek prizes just for reviewing Standard Orbit and our other shows on iTunes or Stitcher. Each review gets you an entry in the drawing, and we'll give you full details at the end of the show. So to start the second part of the commentary, you can fast forward to 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 48 seconds into the movie, just as Terrell is saying how Khan went wild on the Regular One scientists. And once you got that synced up around that point, then you can push play on your DVD or Blu-ray or Netflix on the count of start.
Yeah, or if you're using the Laserdisc, you can just flip it over to side two.
Did I cut it that well?
No, you didn't, which kind of bothered me, honestly, but, you know, what can you do?
Well, you could have told me where the break was.
I was going to, and then you cut it too quickly, I guess, for me. It was my fault. I was even noting it while we were watching the movie, and I'm like, oh, right there, there's a good break. Sorry, my fault.
Okay. Well, get ready to start your player in 3, 2, 1, start. I'd not noticed before until we watched it with the subtitles here, but Kirk, when he's calming Chekhov down, calls him Pav. That's a little personal thing I'd never noticed before.
Yeah, he calls him. Right. He uses a shortened version of his name. He calls him Pavel in 4, also, doesn't he? I always like that one. I always loved it actually when the characters called each other by their first name. When Scotty calls Kirk Jim in the original show. I think only once. I could be mistaken, but I think he only calls him that once. And it's a really great moment, you know, where he's like, you know, Jim, you can't sacrifice yourself, you know. I always thought that was great because, you know, normally they're either using nicknames or last names, and it shows that the characters care about each other. And then to use a shortened version is kind of cool, you know.
Nobody calls McCoy Lenny. That makes me sad.
It's also sort of like a thing. Like, I remember there was one time where, like, I was going to a comic book store, and I was just starting to get back into comics, and my friend who worked there, everyone always calls me Schindler. That's just the way it works, especially there, because there were, like, three Mikes working there. And there was one time where I came up, and I had, like, a huge stack of comics. I'm like, okay, I'm going to buy these. And he's like, you're buying all of these? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, geez, Mike. And I'm like, what? And the fact that he said that name, Mike, I'm like, wow, maybe I should rethink how many comic books I'm buying. And, you know, I mean, that happens here too, you know. I mean, like in, I think it was Into Darkness, where at one point Scotty calls Kirk Jim, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that there's just something about that where it's just like, it's such a simple little thing that you can do in a script, and yet it speaks volumes about that moment, you know?
Yeah, I went to Catholic school in high school, and everyone was known by their last names. And, you know, to 30 years later, I still refer to my friends, some of my closest friends, by their last name. And it's, you know, it is when you're either having a discussion, an argument, or, you know, a moment of sadness or something, and you're sympathizing with your friend that we use their first names. You know, it's a great trick of script writing, as you said. It's also a, you know, because it reflects reality.
Yeah, it still freaks me out. It still freaks me out whenever I'm doing a podcast with Max, because he always calls me Schindler. But when we're on the podcast, he calls me Mike. So anytime he says something like, "Mike, stop that," or something, I'm like, whoa, what happened? Did this just get real? What's going on now? Why are you so mad at me? Why are you calling me Mike?
I don't have that problem at work
because my last name's Stewart. Well, no, my last name's Stewart, and there's a Stewart whose first name at work. So when people say Mr. Stewart, they're actually talking to, you know, because everybody goes by their first name, they're actually talking to the other guy and not me. It's very confusing.
Well, you have an action first name. You have a cool first name. It's Drew. You know, it's like you're Aha. doing something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drawing. It's exciting.
That's all right. It's still something. What am I doing, John? I'm in a room, you know? I'm doing nothing. This scene here where they're fighting was, again, with Bill Couch, much grander, and was filmed where the two of them really had a much bigger fight. In fact, if you remember the movie poster, there's the movie poster that has like different images, like as a border around the poster, there's an image of David over Kirk on the floor with a knife. And that wasn't a publicity photo. That was actually from the film, because the son was going to beat the father at the fight in a way, although it didn't resolve itself because Carol walks in and the two of them stop and get up. So again, so they truncated that, you know, here again, probably a good idea because it preserves the hero status of Kirk, but it, you know, again, a little moment that would have been longer had they kept it.
I mean, I can see that.
Of the Jedi. Sorry.
Poor Jedi.
Return of the Jedi. Revenge of the Jedi.
Yeah. At this point, it would have been Revenge of the Jedi. Yes.
Yeah.
That guy behind Khan here, because whoever looks at that poor guy, you're so focused on Montalban's amazing performance. But that's an actor by the name of Tim Culbertson who is in the movie a lot and is really, other than Yalcom, really the second main Khansman, you know, as they were known on set. He was in like Battlestar Galactica. He was in a bunch of genre stuff. And someone just did an interview with him, a newspaper interview with him. And it was interesting to read about, you know, what it was like to work for him, with Ricardo Montalban, all those young actors with Ricardo Montalban, Laura Banks and Pam Bennett and Judson Scott and Tim Culbertson and all the people on the Reliant Bridge. They you know, talked about, you know, we're working with him. It was like we're working with Hollywood royalty, you know.
There's your cardboard ear again.
There's the ear. Yep. There's the, that's again, look at that. That optical effect is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I know Roddenberry.
They're zooming.
Roddenberry did not like that sequence at all. We have his notes of his what he liked and did not like about the script, and he did not like that because he felt that Kirk would not have done that, that wasn't in the Star Trek spirit. You know, that Kirk would have studied the creature, not killed the creature. So,
well, Spock wasn't there to convince him to study it, though.
Right, and I, you know, you could see it as like, well, geez, this thing is a threat, so I'm going to get rid of it. You know, it makes sense, certainly from a storytelling point of view.
This is my favorite scene.
When I saw this at the IMAX version and whatever it was in the 90s, 96 or 97, they had... the movie, you know, well, it wasn't the IMAX version, but it was in an IMAX theater, right? But it was a big screen version. So anyway, the whole film, people were quiet, laughing when they're supposed to laugh or whatever. But that this whole sequence, word for word, it was like, you know, everyone saying the lines for Kirk and Khan. But it was great. It was wonderful.
Beautiful.
And then everyone went back to being quiet again. As soon as you did the Khan yell, you went back to...
Yeah, I actually saw it then too at Navy Pier. That was great. And that was in 70 millimeter. And the interesting thing about that, which I thought was weird, was that 70 millimeter print had the 2 on it, which I didn't think existed. And then I later saw a 35 millimeter print, which did not have the 2 on it. So that was bizarre. But, yeah.
Yeah, the 2, interesting. When was that exactly added?
It had to have been for like a re-release, but I don't know. I mean, like because I wasn't expecting to see it on that 70 millimeter print. And then I was expecting to see it when I saw the 35 millimeter and it wasn't there. They played it in 35 millimeter at the Art Institute of Chicago. So.
Yeah, they're not, I mean, you know, the reasoning I think probably back then was, because putting a 2 and a 3 in front of a movie was pretty common back then. You know, there might have been two trains of thought. One was you may not want it, from Paramount's point of view, they may not want it to remind people that it was a sequel in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. Not that the first film sold more tickets than any Star Trek film until 2009, if you don't go by, you know, if you count for inflation. But, you know, it was wildly expensive too, so they made much more profit on Star Trek II, I would imagine. But there was that idea, I think, that notion, and then maybe adding it after the fact was a result of, well, there was 3 and there was 4, and, you know, because was there going to be a Star Trek 3 at the time they were making this? Who could have imagined, you know? I think they knew when they assembled it and looked at it, and that's why that ending was changed, because they realized there was going to be a 3. I think they knew that they had a film that would be, it maybe not as successful as it was, but they certainly had a film that they knew would be successful, and that there was a likelihood there was going to be a 3. But at the time they were filming, this, you know, could have been their thinking that this was it, you know, anyway.
I could be mistaken about this, but I believe the way the timeline works from what I've heard is that they were calling it Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan. That's what they put in the actual movie. And then at some point in the marketing, they decided to add the 2. So I think the 2 is in like a lot of the ads and stuff like that. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I heard. And then the 2 was added to the film for home video, I guess, and then later prints.
But, I mean, I've never seen a poster or anything that didn't have the 2 on it.
Yeah.
Not that I can.
Yeah,
recall.
It could be a marketing thing. Yeah, I mean, there are some posters. I think Well, that's interesting. I'd have to look at my album, my record album, and see if the album has the 2 or not. There were some things that didn't. Did the novel when it first came out have the 2? I don't think it did. Again, I can be wrong.
You know, what's really interesting to me that I just saw, which kind of blew my mind in a sense for whatever reason, when I pulled out the Blu-ray disc.
Yep.
The packaging and everything says 2-2-2, but when you open it up and you look at the disc itself, it just says Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan. And like all the other movies have the numerals there, but that one doesn't. Like, interesting. Interesting.
I love.
Yeah, but this is the same
this,
company that gave us the upside down Enterprise B on the Star Trek 6 bonus disc for the DVDs. So.
Okay. Yeah. That's true.
They should have a fan look at that stuff before it goes out. I've always thought
Seriously.
There should be like, you know, someone sits in a room. They don't leave. They just sit there and they show them stuff and say,
yeah, that E is not curved in that Star Trek title. You put that movie back and you correct that font.
Fix that. This is a great scene. You know, again, a scene that I think makes the movie appealing to way more than just science fiction fans. I mean, I know my mother and father, my father likes science fiction, but my mother and father really related to this sequence, just the humanity of this interchange, the theme of growing older, you know, the regrets that people have in their lifetime, you know, the what could have beens and that sort of thing, rekindling a romance here, you know. There's always been a couple questions, you know, that have never been answered. One is, you know, were Kirk and Carol married? Because there are some interviews with William Shatner in the era where he refers to her as having been his wife.
Hmm.
And so, you know, you know, that would be an interesting question. I've never had the chance to ask William Shatner at a convention or anything like that when they take questions. But I, if someone ever does, it would be great to hear that, because I know Ricardo Montalban and Judson Scott, when they rehearsed, they saw the character as father and son, that was his son, and that that's the way they treated the relationship. And there is actually a line in the deleted version. I'm sorry, there's a line in the September 81 version of the script, written by Nicholas Meyer, where after the fight between Kirk and Khan and they beam back up, Khan actually strokes Yalcom's cheek and says, you know, I'm basically says that you were worried about me. I'm touched. And I that seems to be a fatherly thing to do, you know? So, there's no answers in those versions of the script, whether Carol and Kirk were married, and then divorced, you know, after the fact, or was it a scenario where they weren't married in the first place, or, you know, were they father and son, you know, actually Kirk and Khan and Yalcom. So, by the way, if you're watching this scene and seeing the getting ready for the apple, eating the apple, which is great. In Star Trek 2009, he's eating an apple during the Kobayashi movie, which I thought was a really nice moment. Chekhov is actually in the scene, but you never see him. He's sitting off. Yeah, I have the photos of them filming this, and he's sitting off to the side, but because everything's such a close picture, I don't think you ever do see it, even when they do I don't think they ever do a pullback. I don't think you see it other than for a second where you see the whole cave like that from, you don't see it from this angle looking this way. And so you never see Chekhov, but he's there. In fact, during the sequence, which was longer, there's an interchange between David and Savick that was edited out where she says, so you're a bastard. You know, she basically says you're a bastard, says that word. And he's like, yeah, I guess I am, or something. And that's, you know, the beginning of sort of the romance or flirtation between the two of them, which was scripted, and some of that was filmed. So that scene where Kirk, you know, does that wonderful, bites the apple and says, I don't like to lose, that whole scene was longer, and in a portion of that, McCoy was going to get over and check on Chekhov. Chekhov.
If Savick calls him a bastard, then that would imply that they weren't married, right?
Right. So it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I'm interested to know, did Shatner and BBB play that role? Did they talk about that, and did they think of it as former husband and wife? Which, you know, I think in some ways is interesting because it would imply that there's a much larger story, you know, to the two of those characters. I mean, that there was obviously a long term, not necessarily obviously a long term, but you know, that they were part of each other's life in a significant way, that it wasn't a 1 week adventure or fun romance or something. And I think that'd be interesting to kind of know that, you know, knowing the history of the characters. If you look really closely in this scene, well, you don't have to look that closely, it's pretty obvious. One of the cadets that's going down the hallway, they're right there, is James Horner, the composer of the music of the film.
So, I love the Torpedo Room.
Yeah, this was a scene that Nicholas Meyer wanted to do that there was some controversy over. Should they be manually loading the torpedoes, you know? But I think it really works, you know. Plus, of course, it's important for establishing that later on in the film with Spock's funeral scene.
Well, that was actually something that I was going to ask you about, because you touched on it briefly, but you said that you've seen Roddenberry's notes where he talks about, you know, what he liked and what he didn't like. What did he like and what didn't he like? I'm really, really curious about that.
Well, you know, one of the things I thought was fascinating was he was not a stickler for the kind of minutiae that I think we as fans are stickler for sometimes, you know, where if the shields are down and you're not supposed to be able to do so, he was a storyteller. So he knew that sometimes the story needed you to sort of fudge the established universe a little bit. Not egregiously or anything like that, but you know, he would be like, you know, there were things in there, little things where he'd be like, well, they don't use sir, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. So, but he was pretty loose on some of the, like, you would think, like, we as fans would be like, now, wait a second, you can't have a starship, doesn't do that kind of thing, you know. A whole section was about how Spock cannot die for legal reasons, that if they kill Spock, they are depriving him a source of income. You know, so Roddenberry, that he created the character, he decides whether the character is killed or not. I mean, you could certainly understand his point of view, right? I mean, Spock was, and I think still is, like I said, the face of Star Trek. And so to kill him could have meant killing the franchise in a way if it wasn't handled right. And he was adamant about that. He did not like that. He did not like the scene where, you know, that the way they killed the SETI Eel. He did not like the militaristic trappings. He did not. The Enterprise was based on the Navy to some degree, you know, but he did not like the sort of ranking, the pipping. He did not like the uniforms, anything like that. There were a lot of objections about the character of David, because he kind of felt, not that David existed or that David was Kirk's son or anything like that, but more that he felt David was sort of doltish, you know, not using the word entitlement minded, but in some ways, you know, sort of this set up little upstart kind of punkish kind of kid, and that he needed to be reworked, you know. And what's even more fascinating is seeing what the reaction is to those notes. And there were things that were taken, the notes that he was the script consultant and executive consultant on the film. And they did take some of his suggestions, and others were, you know, dismissed. Obviously, they went ahead with Spock, especially as one of those. But yeah, I mean, it's great reading it, because, you know, to me, that's getting into the mind of Roddenberry, who created it all, and who, and really deserves. I mean, he deserves a lot of credit in the Khan history as well. It was Gene Roddenberry who wrote the final version of Space Seed, and that was a script that Gene Kuhn contributed to. Kerry Wilbur wrote the story treatment for it, and also one pass at the script. And they had serious problems until a few days before filming was supposed to begin, and Roddenberry fixed it all. And he helped, along with Gene Kuhn, really helped make Khan the character who he became. So, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for that, for setting up and establishing Khan as such a strong character in Space Seed. In addition, of course, to creating the whole universe of Star Trek, obviously, as well.
Was there anything in those notes where Roddenberry was like, that's really cool, I'm glad that this is in that movie?
Yeah, he did like that Kirk was using that. I think he doesn't come out and say it in terms of like, well, it didn't occur in the first film, but because it did. But I think he was happy with the fact that Kirk was an intellectual character, that he was using his mind and the technology and the science. You know, there was a concern about the science too, and he praised the science. He liked the innovative idea of the terraforming notion and things like that. And then there were other things occasionally where he'd be like, you know, well, you better check with the science people. Is it possible? Well, you know, if you were really in a nebula, what would occur? That kind of thing. And that was always something he was concerned with. We have, we've been doing, our latest research has been going through about 2000 newspaper articles over the last 50 years and looking at them. And one of the things we found were a couple of writings by Gene Roddenberry, where the articles, we just started writing a four-part series for StarTrek.com about those newspaper articles, but one of the articles, two actually, were written by Gene Roddenberry himself right before Star Trek came on. And I love anything like that where, because you really get to see what his interpretation of the characters, of what was happening to the characters, how do you, and in those 1966 newspaper articles, how do you explain Star Trek to people? And that's coming directly from the creator. So, you know, unfortunately, there isn't a lot. There wasn't enough done with him. You know what I mean? Because people weren't, the making of that type of, you know, that world of interest in the making of something wasn't as big as it is today. And so I really wish there had been even more. I would have loved to have seen, you know, Gene Roddenberry write the definitive making of Star Trek book. I mean, we come close with the making of Star Trek by Stephen Whitfield, who's, I think his real name is Stephen Poe. There wasn't enough. There weren't enough interviews, frankly, in my opinion. There weren't enough chances for Roddenberry to tell us what he thought about things. And of course, he kept relatively quiet publicly about the Star Trek films after him because, you know, he utilized his position. I mean, you know, he was smart. If he came out against the film, it would have hurt it. So they had to kind of listen to some of his suggestions, but he was wise enough to know that they weren't going to listen to all of them, you know, and that you fight the big battles and not the small stuff.
So, do you know, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Nicholas Meyer does write about in his biography. It was a contentious relationship, you know, between Harv Bennett and Gene, and between Nicholas Meyer and Gene Roddenberry, it was. And of course, I could imagine not easy to be the person coming in and having to deal with Gene Roddenberry, and then not being easy being Gene Roddenberry, having to deal with, you know, people coming in and in essence controlling what, you know, you created. It couldn't be easy for anyone on either side. But of course, they were able to work with each other enough that we got, you know, great Star Trek films. So
that was my favorite part. The Enterprise coming behind, you know, rising behind the Reliant.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that at all my favorite parts.
Something you don't see a lot in science fiction, right? The use of up and down in space. You know, it's always sideways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? So it was great. Yeah.
So on the whole, do you know of any of Roddenberry's reaction to the finished film? Is there any time that he's ever... it's spoken about whether or not he likes it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he thought, you know, he called it a great adventure. I think his affinity was more for Star Trek IV of the films that were done that were not under his producership. Mm-hmm. He was not a fan of Star Trek V, more because of the themes of it, the religious themes of it. Had some problems with six, although gave it his approval right before he passed away, unfortunately, in 1991. But you know, he liked it enough that he approved of it and it got his approval. But he did not like he interpreted the characters, the Enterprise characters, as acting in a racist fashion, and did not like that, and you know, that element of that. So, you know, it was always, but of the films, at least in terms of what I've seen, the least commentary was on Wrath of Khan, partially because I think he was still trying to figure out what his role was now, you know, and what he should say or shouldn't say. You know, but he was very upset about Spock's death, even after the film, although he felt they handled it in a dignified way, if I remember right, but not necessarily happy with it.
Yeah. So here we have Khan activating the Genesis device.
So is this some kind of safety measure to make sure you don't accidentally turn it on? Oh, you got to turn this, and you turn this, and then you spin this, and then you push this, and then you...
It makes sense. I mean, it's similar to like Alien, you know.
Right. That's what I was going to say. It's kind of like Alien. Like, if you really want to overload the ship, you've got to push this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a modern faucet, I believe. It doesn't look like, it looks like a faucet. But this is the scene where you would have had the second appearance of the Khan baby, as it's called, right there. The Khan toddler would have been crawling around the torpedo, and then as it detonated, would have been implying that being the first to be killed.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's horrific, right? But you know, the idea was, and I think it's a great idea, but you know, it would have been disturbing. It may have even overshadowed Spock's death, I think, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a wise thing not to actually do it. But they did try to film
in the transporter room.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
He's a cute little baby. We have the pictures of them filming that. I mean, a cute little kid. You know, to me looks like, you know, maybe about 2 years, well, maybe not 2 years old, but, you know, certainly under two, but has a little Khan. I mean, it's not like a parody, but the hair is a little bit long, like Khan, you know, I could
is
see
he showing
how,
off his baby pecs.
Yeah. I mean, he has a little bit of, you know, I mean, it looks a little, I could see how there was confusion over the years where people thought that was supposed to be Khan's kid, you know, but that would have implied his wife either took another wife, which would have negated this whole, you know, revenge motif, thing. I think. Yeah. Yeah. Or that his wife had only recently died, which, you know, but, they tried filming it. The baby, it's funny that the little kid is crying when looking at the torpedo. So I think there was a problem with that, just the kid in reality being scared of it. But I think the idea of it was to show that Khan's, and we had asked Mr. Meyer about this too, and he had told us that the idea was to show that Khan's people were trying to survive, that they could continue, and that the Khan really betrayed his people because he put his own vengeance above his people's future. His people did have a future, and he lost that for them. Whereas Spock here is sacrificing himself so that his comrades could have a future. I mean, you get that, you know, but according to Mr. Ratt, just didn't work. It that didn't come across. And so that was taken out and, you know, again, wisely so. Cause we'd still be, I think we'd all be in shock still, you know, but.
So here we have Spock's death scene. It still works. It still works really well.
That's another great edit, like just that device, that technology, mm-hmm. like Drew was saying earlier. I mean, what is that? You know what I mean? Like what cares?
What is it?
I mean,
turn something inside this thing that shoots radiation. I don't understand.
Yeah, and you know, and it's so great because we didn't need to understand it. You know, like it did, and what it does, of course, you get the just visually a similarity between the Genesis torpedoes countdown and it's growing and it's light and Spock in the light, you know, I mean, there's so much really cool stuff here, you know,
it also,
you know,
seems
symbolism
like,
in the film.
It also seems like a doable task, you know, I mean, like whenever I watch Into Darkness and, you know, Kirk is doing basically the same thing, I'm always like, there is no way that thing is moving for him, you know? How is this going to work, Kirk? You know?
Right.
Whereas here I'm like, okay, he can do this. It's just going to kill him.
I think it shows also the power of the music, too. I think what makes it palatable and Into Darkness is the music, which is really beautiful when he's sacrificing himself. And then, interestingly, a little bit more... here anyway, a little bit more action adventure music, which keeps it where I think you're still kind of hopeful, you know, I mean, there's still this idea of when Kirk is doing it, you already sense doom. When Spock is doing it, you're sensing sacrifice, but you're thinking, no, he's going to make it. Cause he still, you kind of have that little fun, almost fun, adventuresome music. that's playing really until you get to this sequence. And even when he stands up, because when he says he's dead already, you think he's dead already, not meaning he's sentenced to death. And when he stands up, you get a moment of hope, you know, that maybe Spock's going to make it, that it's just like the original show, you know, it's the Tholian web all over again. You know, no one's dead. You know, I prefer this because it plays with you more. It doesn't telegraph as much. It's still trying to get you to see things, to trick you in a way, so that you're seeing something you're not seeing, you know?
How many times in the original series is like, oh, Spock's blind. Oh, wait, you know, he's Vulcan. You know, we could fix that.
And he's got eight eyelids.
Oh, no, he's got this alien on that's going to take over his mind. Nope, he's Vulcan. And there's just all kinds of... There's precedent for maybe Vulcans are immune to certain types of radiation. I don't know.
Maybe we have some of Khan's blood.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, but anyway, just a couple things there. Yeah, the music in this is really good. And it's so good, in fact, that James Horner used it for every other movie that he ever worked on. but I will say that I do like the way that the music in Into Darkness plays in this scene, because to me, like, while this one is sort of like keeping up the idea of it being like an adventure and hope and sort of like an action beat in a sense, in that one, I feel like it plays counter to what's on screen, whereas like there's action on screen, but the music has sort of reached a level of transcendence where it's just sort of like accepted Kirk's fate, and is just sort of like building to this crescendo of well, yeah, transcendence. But it works very well in a completely different way. Also, the scene that we just saw that shot just a second ago with Spock on the ground, kneeling on the ground, and in some magazine somewhere, I don't even know where it came from, but there was a publicity still, I'm assuming, of that shot, essentially, where the camera was really low to the ground and you just see Spock, you know, sitting on the ground, kneeling on the ground with his back to the camera. And it's just such a beautiful image which captures this entire scene. And I liked it so much that I cut it out and I hung it up on the wall at work, where it stayed for like 10 years. So I'd always see that image. And I'm like, I wish that was in the movie because it is such a beautiful photograph. But and it sums up the entire scene in just that one image. Is great.
Yeah, the set, I could be wrong, so don't quote me on this. I believe the set photographer was a man by the name of Bruce Beamer. And he did, you know, the photography while they were filming different scenes. And, you know, all of his footage was black and white, and at least most of it was black and white. And it's always beautiful, I think. Was that a black and white picture, or was that a
color? No, it was color, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, they did do a few color things, and you know, it's the beautiful photography. His work has been so helpful with our work trying to look at the making of the film. It's really his pictures that we're looking at. This is great in terms of the acting. I mean, you know, Leonard Nimoy was nominated every single year he played Spock on the original show, and I really always felt that he and this was certainly at least him and Ricardo Montalban deserved some sort of Academy recognition for this film. Cause I thought they both did just, you know, amazing jobs. And, you know, William Shatner, there's not a single actor who's off their game. No, you know, the emotion is there in every scene. I love that because it's so fast, but when you look there, you see all the cadets assembled at the top as that comes, mm-hmm. as that is lowered down. And I love that sort of his friends are closest to him, but his students are above, you know, above him. And with Savick was actually to have a much bigger presence in the film. In fact, she had a speech during this sequence too, where she basically was saying, you know, about him being her teacher, and you know, she cries during that sequence. And I'm trying to see if I have, I have it here. This is what she would have said. This was scripted. Vulcan philosophy deals with death differently than other cultures, but as my teacher and guide, Captain Spock endeavored to show me how people of goodwill may combine and integrate their convictions. The service I am about to read reflects that ideal. And then she reads something in Vulcan, and we don't know exactly what she says. But again, it was the idea that, you know, that they beefed up her role initially because she was going to become the person who replaces, if you can, who follows Spock in the next film.
She can only succeed him. She can never replace him.
Exactly. Exactly.
My shoes, Doctor.
And there's Todd Bryant again. He's everywhere in this film. This is a great example, by the way, of using the camera low. This set is very small, and they keep cutting it in half to make it look bigger. But basically where they're at is exactly where Kirk's at. It's a very, very small set. But by filming low, again, the brilliance of Craig Denault and Gayne Rusher, just with the way that they milked those sets for what they were worth, made that look like a much longer set than it actually was.
So here we're coming up on David's encounter with Kirk. Now, how did Kirk finish that book so quickly? I mean, come on. Hasn't he been busy?
He's been really busy. Well, there were 12 hours away from regular one. Okay. I mean, there's a couple times where they say it's been a couple, you know, it'll be a day or so before we get there.
Okay, fair enough.
I love the symbolism of that, where you know, Spock gives him the book, so Spock gives him information. McCoy gives him the glasses, so McCoy gives him the ability to interpret the information that Spock gives him. But because Spock is dead, Kirk can no longer access that information. So the broken glasses, to me, always represented, you know, the breaking of the trilogy of the characters. You know, it's always Kirk. It's, you know, the id ego, superego. It's Kirk in the middle. Spock is logic. The superego, McCoy, is the id. You know, not carrying that too far, but he's the id. He's the, you know, he's the emotion. He's the prism by which you understand the words and the text. And because Spock is gone, Kirk can't read that information anymore. The glasses are broken. He can't see it with his own eyes. I always loved that idea, that, and to me, those glasses being broken had to be intentional. You know, that was not just maybe I have the interpretation wrong, but that's what I, you know, that there's some symbolism there with that.
Yeah. Makes sense.
He's a good actor too, Merritt Buttrick. He, you know, so many people are gone who made this film. It's behind and in front of the camera. You know, Craig Denault, the cameraman, died at a young age. B.B. Beach died young. We lost Paul Winfield a few years ago. Of course, Ricardo Montalban is gone 5 years now. Merritt Buttrick passed away. You know, we've lost, of course, DeForest Kelley and James Doohan, and just, It's you know, the normal passage of time, but it's you know, it's sad because I there are so many questions about the making of this film, and so many people you can't ask anymore, because I never felt this film got the making of attention it deserved. You know, it deserves a big giant coffee table book like the Star Wars films do. I think it's that important, you know, and I think it's that good. And dare I say, I enjoy it more, frankly, you know, than any other Star Trek film for sure. But I love them all. The Star Trek is like pizza, right? There's no bad pizza. There's no bad Star Trek. You know, but there are some that taste
obviously
a little
you
better.
Haven't had Papa John's, but
whoa.
Obviously not a sponsor of your show.
Well, they were going to be. Jeez.
Well, there you go.
For lunch.
I guess they'll have to stick with Peyton Manning, you know. Oh, well. Sucks to be them. But yeah. You know, here's the whole scene where, you know, I mean, in this movie, a lot about this movie is about, you know, these characters getting older and everything like that. And I had an interesting little encounter yesterday where when I was at work, I just had this movie playing in the background, you know, just to kind of get a feel for it or whatever. Wasn't really watching it or whatever. And my coworker was coming in and out of the room, and he's 10 years younger than me and not a big Star Trek fan at all. He's seen the new movies and that's it. And he looks at it and he's like, "That's William Shatner?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Wow, he looks so young."
Wow.
And I'm like, "Okay, now I feel old. Now I know what Kirk feels like in Star Trek 2. Thanks, dude."
They had a line in the in that scene where McCoy gives Kirk a birthday present that was in there. They did film a longer version. We have the pictures of that where Kirk has to be taught how to use the glasses, which is really a cute scene. McCoy's like, "No, you look down this way," you know. And it's in fact, if you watch that scene real carefully, there is a tiny bit of an odd edit when they go from the two shot of them to Kirk, and then they go back to a two shot and the glasses are down. And that's because they edited out the scene where he taught, you know, that. But there was also a line in there where Kirk says, rhetorically, I think he says, "How the hell old are you anyway?" And Kirk says, "I'm 49. So they were going to establish his age in the film, but that was taken out as well. So, but yeah, 49, you know, I'm, you know, that's not old. It was old when I saw the film in 1982, but it's not old now.
So we just saw the little sequence which was added to make way for Star Trek 3, and I know that Meyer, at least initially, wasn't very happy with it. Now he doesn't really care, but right? But I mean, it's kind of, I like, every time I see it now, I'm like, oh, it's too bad that's there. I can see why he'd be upset, because it's kind of like we spend this whole movie leading up to this thing and then we kill him and then we're going to end it, you know, like 2 minutes later with, "Oh, but wait, maybe he's not dead. Hey," you know?
It's annoying. Same with the
Yeah, I mean, that had to be, you know, I could see that being, especially as the script writer and the director, that had to be hard, you know, a heart-wrenching addition, you know, because they really did treat Spock's death with a great deal of dignity. It had a purpose to it. It was, brilliantly acted, excellently directed. The music was beautiful. I mean, it was wonderful. And, is it a cheat in a way to make you feel happy when you leave? You know, I mean, that being said, you know, I think he realizes that it would be difficult and maybe even wrong to do Star Trek without Spock. And so, the original show. And so, I say he came to terms with that, I think, what I like about it is looking at the end credits here at the very beginning of the film, there's, just the brief thing where it says, you know, in the 23rd century, which Nicholas Meyer says he put in for his dad so that his dad would understand when when the film occurred, you know, as his dad wasn't a Star Trek fan, and neither was Nicholas Meyer. And, but I think that's, again, a great example of judicious use of storytelling. You know, you don't need a big preamble of what do you need to know? The 23rd century. And I always felt that way about the credits too here. They're not flashy. There's nothing fancy about them. But the music and the names, and as I see the names now and they go across, now I know, you know, there's Bill Couch's names, you know, the names, there you go. Still photographer was Bruce Bermelin. That's how you say his last name, who took those great pictures. To see the names of the people and now to know who they are because of Bruce's fantastic photographs and Nicholas Meyer having his collection at the University of Iowa has just been really rewarding, because the names really mean a great deal to me, you know, and I love learning about the contributions of each of the people that worked on the film.
I saw a stunt man. His name was John Robotham, but I would like to assume that he pronounces it Robotham, because why wouldn't you? Do you know anything about him?
Yeah, he was part of the team with Bill Couch, and there was a whole group of the performers. Steve Blaylock was another one. Steve Blaylock was mostly, he was an actor too. He was actually in Star Trek III when Moro is walking around saying he's going to decommission the Enterprise. He's one of the cadets that's right there prominently. But Steve Blaylock was Leonard Nimoy's stand-in and stunt double. There was actually Bill Couch Jr. and Bill Couch Sr. There was a really great team of people. He was one of that team of men and women who did a great job with the stunts. Because really, when you think about it, there are an awful lot of them in this film, especially during the fight sequences between the Enterprise and the Reliant. There's quite a bit of stunt work. And also the Kobayashi Maru sequence.
You know, there was just a thing, Peter Amundsen, if I'm not mistaken, he was, they listed him as an effects editor, right? But he's gone on to actually become like a big editor. He cut Pacific Rim and Shoot 'Em Up and Hellboy. He's Guillermo del Toro's editor now. So, yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, you see Ken Ralston's name from ILM in here. I mean, all these people who went on to do, you know, amazing work in other films, you know. Got their start, or at least cut some of their teeth anyway on this film.
The only thing that I can think of, though, while watching these credits, especially the one that says filmed in Panavision, is that for the Laserdisc, in order to make the credits bigger, they took off the anamorphic lens and then made it 4x3 so that they're all squished together but larger. That bothers me. What can you do?
Yeah, one of my favorite pictures from the collection is Nicholas Meyer standing next to the camera, you know, the camera, the big one.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's a beautiful picture.
Those are always good pictures.
Yeah.
I imagine it's better than the obviously staged one from Motion Picture where Robert Wise is like pointing and
yeah.
Like, we're making a movie.
Over there. Point the camera over there.
There you just had the ultimate trivia question of all time. What Motion Picture Association of America number is Star Trek 2? Right?
I didn't even know they had numbers until I just noticed that. Something. I'm like, yeah. Wow.
26694. That is, that will stump anybody. And I only know that because I just saw it right now, you know?
Oh, okay, good. It's not like we should expect this at like Star Trek Vegas during the trivia contest.
No, I don't think anyone's going to think of that one.
Well, Mike, you have to make that happen.
Yeah. Well, that was Wrath of Khan. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. It was enlightening.
Yeah, very.
Thanks, guys. I had a great time. Any chance to watch Wrath of Khan?
And we'll have you back for Into Darkness.
For sure. In the meantime, you said you've got, I know I saw it just yesterday, I think, the first part of that new series on StarTrek.com went up.
Yeah, we're doing, we're trying to get the information out now. We did, Creation was kind enough to have us in Chicago and Boston. And also, we're going to be sharing it with fans who can't make it to conventions or local talks here. Through StarTrek.com. So it's there's a really fascinating history, some of it forgotten history, some of it challenging the timeline of how we think about things that came out through this newspaper research. So there's a lot of great trivia in there. For example, in the article that's up now at StarTrek.com, a little chatter about Star Trek being thought of as a mid-season replacement when it was first going to be on NBC. So you know, the little things like that that haven't been out there a whole lot. We want to share with the fans and with the readers at StarTrek.com. So, yeah, it's going to be over the next few months. We got a couple other fun articles, little collectibles articles and things like that are coming too. But this is part of a four-part series we're doing for that. And we're also going to be doing some talks at the libraries. You know, if we're invited for any other creation conventions, we'd definitely be happy about that and share that with fans there, because that's always a great way to share the information with people visually, you know.
And I saw the presentation in Chicago, and it was really cool and informative, and I learned some stuff which I had never known before, and we're going to have you on to talk about that as well. The Wrath of the Titan, what was it called? The Titans of the Planet of the Titans? What was
Planet? Yeah, Planet of Titans and Planet of Titans, depending on which version. Yeah.
Yes, we definitely want to have you on to talk about that, because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
But
Star Trek really needs some really good historical work. I know some people are you know, have been doing that for years. Larry Nemasek is one of them, of course, and Richard Arnold, and you know, I you know, there's so much history there, and you know, we often get, when we see like documentaries and things like that on TV, you get kind of the same information again and again, and it's important because you got to tell the story, you know, for each new generation who's just kind of coming into Trek or maybe has not seen a documentary before. But this kind of research allows us to kind of do these kind of niche, you know, really look deeply at something like the making of Wrath of Khan or Star Trek in newspapers and things like that, and then share a little bit of history that doesn't get spoken of an awful lot. So, you know, there's Richard Arnold is great to listen to. He does great presentations at conventions, and Larry is working on, I know, a documentary about a famous Star Trek convention called the Con of Wrath, which is really very much related to this film. It would happen conjointly with the movie, time wise. And so I'm privileged to do anything where I can share the information that my wife and I are researching on that. And if I could plug one thing, we're going to be doing a talk in October at the Cook Memorial Library. People just go online and search the Cook Memorial Library and then look at their events, they'll see it. It's free, but it's a look at the life of Ricardo Montalban. It's a remarkable life. His life is much, much bigger than any one character he ever played, whether it was Mr. Rourke or Khan. And so there's definitely Star Trek in the talk, and including some rare pictures and never before seen pictures that we're going to show. But it's really all about his whole life, and a life of just sort of compassion and volunteerism and activism and dignity, and just, I mean, if anybody needs a role model in life, I can't think of a better one than Ricardo Montalban. So we're really happy to be able to give that presentation, and it's free for the community, but they do ask people to register. So that's going to be in October. So you get a little bit of Star Trek, but also a lot more about Ricardo Montalban as a person.
All right. Well, thank you very much again for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we can't wait to have you back. Sorry, I apologize. I'm going to hell.
Into punness.
Well, let's wait. All let's right. Hold those puns for the episode.
All right.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that was another successful commentary with John Tenuto. We always appreciate having him on, and really look forward to the Into Darkness commentary.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just one of the Trek topics we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network. So check out those shows and get on the daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox, or Zune. And you can stream from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. Well, if you want to contact us and share your thoughts on today's show or any of our other shows, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. You can choose to send a show and choose Standard Orbit. That'll come to both of us by email. You can also use the tab on the left-hand side of any page to send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone, and you can talk to us and our other listeners on our forums at trek.fm/forums. In social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Mike, where can people find you out of orbit?
Well, you can find me right here on Trek FM doing commentary Trek Stars with Max, and on last week's episode, the one that dropped just on Friday, we have a special guest named
Who?
Drew. His name is Drew.
Oh,
yeah.
He sounds awesome.
Not really. But we talk about Tabletop, Will Wheaton's first show, so that's cool.
Yeah, I like that show.
Yeah. You should watch it. It's good. You can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com, where I do Off Topic with Max and our friend Brandon. You can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.
You can find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. And you can find me on other Trek FM shows, including Commentary Trek Stars. Wait a minute. We've got an iTunes review. This one is called Still Going Strong. It's 5 stars by Liquid Cross. Nearly 50 years later, there's still plenty to talk about when it comes to TOS. Drew and Mike truly plumb the depths of this classic slab of science fiction, covering the obvious to the obscure, and even going beyond the series into related media like tie-in products and the 2009 reboot. There's a lot to be said about Kirk, Spock, and crew, so I'd wager 400 quatloos that these guys will entertain you.
I think we should get Liquid to start writing our episode synopses.
Yes, he uses awesome words like classic slab of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I need to add that to the description of the show on iTunes.
Yeah.
Well, reviews are very important to us, not only because we like to hear what you think, but also because they impact how we place in iTunes and on Stitcher. Reviews make it easier for other Star Trek fans to find our shows. We know that it does take some extra time to visit iTunes and Stitcher to write the reviews, so as an added incentive to share your thoughts on our shows, we're giving away some great prizes as part of a month-long promotion. These include a season of Star Trek, Your Choice, on Blu-ray or DVD, an official Starships collection ship from Japan, complete with Japanese magazines, Star Trek novels, and a full collection of our alien art badges. Winners will be drawn at random for all entries received before midnight Pacific time on July 31st, 2014. All you need to do to enter is to leave us a rating and review on iTunes and or Stitcher. You can leave only one review per show, of course, but you can review multiple shows and do both on iTunes and Stitcher. And for each review, you'll receive one entry in the drawing. Remember, you can also review the master feed, and that'll give you an entry as well. There are 2 steps for entering. 1, leave a review on iTunes and or Stitcher, and then visit trek.fm/review and complete the form. And we want to thank Liquid Cross, who has successfully, I assume, entered in to win.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope that he filled out the review form on trek.fm/review so that he could possibly win prizes.
If you didn't, Liquid, go to it. I assume that Liquid Cross was a she. No?
I don't know.
Anyway.
Maybe they should write in to the trek.fm/contact and yeah. Let us know.
But make sure you do go fill out that form, because, I mean, come on. It's like you have a chance at winning one of those Blu-ray sets. Those things are like $500 a piece.
I'd rather have the Japanese Starship collection ship.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, I know. I'm a crazy person.
Because that's probably like, you know, what, $20? Whereas like,
but I can stream the episodes of Star Trek. I can't stream diecast ships.
You can't stream the original versions of the original series, can you?
Yes, you can.
On Amazon? All right. Okay. You win. But still, the quality is not as good. The quality is
not. No, it's not.
No. So.
Yeah. And you don't get any bonus features, which is sad.
There you go.
But either way, I don't know if you get to choose or if we get to choose.
It says of your choice.
Oh, of your choice. It's even better.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't think that we're able to win.
No, that makes me upset. But what can you do?
Well, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Standard Orbit to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible's the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's World, Audible has something for everyone. Mike, do you have something for everyone?
Yeah, I have the second part of the Eugenics Wars series, We talked about part one last week, and this week there's Star Trek, The Eugenics Wars, The Rise and Fall of Khan Noonien Singh, Volume 2, which was also written by Greg Cox. This one's narrated by René Auberjonois.
Oh my gracious.
Yeah, you know, he's the guy from Eyes of Laura Mars.
He was also the guy who did the voice of the French chef in Little Mermaid.
Right, exactly, right.
Wow.
And he's done some TV too, like Boston Legal. Anyway,
wow,
he's all over the place. The synopsis on Audible says, many unanswered questions remain about the terrible eugenics wars that raged on Earth during the 1990s, an apocalyptic conflict that brought civilization to the brink of a new dark age. Centuries later, as Captain James T. Kirk and the crew of the Starship Enterprise are forced to defend a colony of genetically enhanced humans against Klingon aggression and sabotage, Kirk must probe deeper into the past and into the glory days of one of the greatest adversaries he has ever faced. And you can get this book for free on Audible since you listen to Standard Orbit.
That's right. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today, catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read, and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So everybody, thanks for listening. Have a good week and keep on trekking. It is the will of Landry.
Mr. Chekhov, take us out of orbit. Ahead, warp factor 1.
Hi, sir.